Listen to the best of the church's music for the Epiphany season at LutheranPublicRadio.org. Sacred music for the Epiphany season, 24/7. LutheranPublicRadio.org.
We're going to stop the ridiculous trade deals that are taking everybody out of our country and taking companies out of our country. And it's going to be reversed. I think you're going to have a lot of companies come back to our country.
That's President Donald Trump speaking to reporters after today's executive order to scrap the proposed Pacific Rim Trade Pact, known as Trans-Pacific Partnership. That was one executive order among several that he signed. The other freezes federal workforce hiring. That's just budget control. But the third that he signed was of great interest to pro-life people. It has to do with the Mexico City policy and funding from the United States to non-governmental organizations, especially for abortion and abortion access. We're going to be talking about those three executive orders on this Monday afternoon, January the 23rd, along with the Women's March on Washington and Donald Trump's inaugural address. Joining us to talk about those three issues, Mark Hemingway. He is senior writer for the Weekly Standard. Mark, welcome back to Issues, Etc.
Glad to be here again.
And Molly will join us here in just a moment from The Federalist to discuss these issues. Mark, to begin with you, let's talk about that list of executive orders, three of them signed by the president. The Mexico City policy had great impact on abortion, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, and then finally a freeze on federal workforce hiring. What are your thoughts?
Well, Donald Trump said he was going to hit the ground running, and, he's off. Just the question is whether or not more unilateral executive action is what the doctor ordered. Certainly there have been a lot of problems we've had, I think, because people in the executive, both under Bush and Obama, have leaned on executive action to do things that really should constitutionally require the approval of Congress. Having said that, some of these policies, like, for instance, for a long time it's been understood and generally agreed that presidents had wide latitude to negotiate trade deals, because subjecting complex agreements to a vote of that many people in Congress, it was generally agreed that that wasn't a very sort of efficient way to do it. So rescinding TPP, traditionally the president would have a wide latitude to do something like that. However, what Trump is doing here so generally cuts against the grain of a bipartisan consensus of free trade, although certainly the Bernie Sanders campaign started to erode that on the left, Mike Lee just introduced the Global Trade Accountability Act. Sorry, Mike Lee is a senator from Utah that wants to require any new trade deal to be subject to approval by Congress, because obviously people in Congress are having some angst about the turn against free trade. So there's going to be a lot of issues that are sort of cropping up. They've been bubbling to the surface under Obama, and Trump might really, cause some angst, even with a Republican Congress, if he continues to press this much, unilateral executive action.
Well, okay, since you've mentioned it, I believe that when Obama was running the first time, one of his strongest criticisms against George W. Bush was the fact that he said George W. Bush was ruling by executive order, promised not to do it. Well, after his eight years, he's doing it on a regular basis. And yet, right out of the box, we have three in one afternoon from Donald Trump. I think they kind of are designed to hit all of the tone of his campaign promises. But this is no way to rule a country, is it?
No, it's absolutely not. And, part of the problem here, though, is Congress, because Congress definitely needs to reassert its, authority constitutionally. Congress has let all this happen for a long time, let the administrative state and the executive branch just metastasize for a long time, because they don't want to be held accountable for having to vote on things. It's easy to blame Washington. I mean, it's easy to blame the White House when you're running for re-election rather than take accountability for not doing something or doing something that your voters don't like. So, this is a real problem. And not only that, some of these things are like really granular issues too, and it just seems like that's not the kind of things that the president should be getting in the weeds on. Like, for instance, one of the things that Trump signed was an executive order canceling a mortgage premium cut, the Federal Housing Authority. You know, it's really a testament to how off the rails things have gotten, that both that the administrative agencies and the executive branch have so much rulemaking authority, and at the same time that the president is getting in the weeds of it himself.
Molly, I want your thought on the executive orders, but especially the one that reinstated the Mexico City policy that deals with non-governmental organizations and abortion access.
The Mexico City policy refers to a policy that forbids taxpayer funding from being used to fund non-governmental organizations that either do abortions or promote abortions abroad. And it was a policy, then Bill Clinton used an executive order to lift the policy, George W. Bush put the policy back in, Barack Obama took it away, and Donald Trump has now put it back in. So this is an example of why it's important to have a pro-life president or someone who will at least support pro-life policies, because it deals with a lot of funding and it deals with a very contentious issue, albeit one where the American public is very opposed to taxpayer funding of abortion. It's something like 80% of Americans, even if they're pro-choice, they don't believe in taxpayer funding of abortions. So that's something that is handled by the Hyde Amendment, which is a legislative amendment that's been in place for a long time. It's really a collection of amendments dealing with domestic funding, but the way it's handled through for foreign funding is through executive authority.
Do you think, Molly, that this signals his resolve should Congress decide to defund Planned Parenthood domestically?
I hope it shows that resolve. President Trump gave conflicting views on Planned Parenthood when he was running for office. He obviously benefited quite a bit from the support of pro-lifers who were kind of sick and tired of Congress not fighting to have things go in a pro-life direction and not having the results they want. The key to defunding Planned Parenthood has always been having a pro-life president who will sign what Congress passes. Congress did defund Planned Parenthood repeatedly, working in that direction over the last several years. It's just that it was going nowhere with President Obama in charge. I think that this is an area where it shows that pro-lifers made a calculation that they think is going to pay off. They knew that Donald Trump was not some kind of pro-life stalwart, but they, by giving him the votes he needed, he owes them a great deal as well. And so I think that this is just a relationship where they both need each other and are able to work together for that reason.
Mark, what did you make of President Trump's inaugural address?
Well, it was a very interesting and very unconventional address. Usually, inaugural addresses are time for a lot of soaring rhetoric, and they're generally something where the president puts out this big speech where they try and issue this sort of unifying message. And Trump didn't quite do that. I mean, I wouldn't say the speech was not uplifting in places or didn't try and explicitly pursue solidarity among the American people, but he made it very clear that this is almost a declaration of war against the Washington establishment. He said very explicitly that people in Washington have been prospering at a time when people in the rest of the country have not, and that he aimed to fix that. He came to upset the established order, and he laid out that theme very clearly and very starkly in a pleasantly brief address.
Molly, what stood out to you?
Just real quick, I feel a little bit bad about how I characterized Donald Trump on the abortion issue. He had spoken in favor of Planned Parenthood or against defunding it. He has also been pretty outspoken in his pro-life stance in the last year, and he deserves credit for that, even bringing up in the debate the extremism of Hillary Clinton's position that would permit abortions for all 9 months of pregnancy. So I just felt a little bit bad that I was not giving him the full benefit of the doubt there. As far as the speech, I concur with what Mark was just saying. There was no question that what he was saying was, I meant what I said during the campaign. I am not softening. I'm not backing down. I'm not going to be a creature of the establishment. I really want to change the way things are done here. And it was kind of brave to say it in a town where everybody, it's a town that's 94% voted for Hillary Clinton, in front of Republicans and Democrats who opposed him, in front of previous presidents who he has spoken against strongly, not just Barack Obama, but also George W. Bush. And so it was a really invigorating thing to hear his commitment to change and also a very brief speech that didn't leave any confusion about what his intentions were. So it lacked things that you might want if you're a conservative, a bold call for liberty or a recursion to our founding principles. At the same time, there were things that conservatives could be very happy about with its call to self-government.
Mark, before we go to this break, often what happens in a presidential campaign when they're doing primaries, they're looking for the faithful. And so they're running as far, whether left or right, depending on where the faithful happen to be. Then in the general, they run back toward the center. And that's usually where they stay, as you said, for inaugural addresses. They stay there as the unifier. Do you think that Donald Trump's address there is an indication, or how strong an indication do you think it is, that he's going to try and do what he promised? He's going to try and do, unlike so many presidents who kind of leave a lot of the promises behind.
Right. Well, you know, certainly one of the great things about Donald Trump is that no matter what happens, he's always Donald Trump and does and says what he thinks. And one of the worst things about Donald Trump is that he's always Donald Trump and does and says what he thinks, regardless of whether or not, there are consequences that he should be thinking about, or he should be thinking about how to act more sensitively, given, you know, the particular moment. On one hand, I bet a lot of people did find that sort of encouraging, but on the other hand, you know, there's a reason why people tack back to the center. And we have to remember that Donald Trump, you know, even though he's duly elected, and I think all the arguments against, his legitimacy are dumb, he still did get, 3 million less votes than Hillary Clinton. And he needs to be very cautious about, sort of his political image on some level. It doesn't mean he can't be an aggressive conservative. It just means that he can't just, rub everything in everybody's faces all the time, because he's got a midterm election coming up sooner than he knows it. And, who knows what could happen. We certainly saw big upheaval in the midterms during Obama's presidency. We certainly saw upheaval during the 2006 midterm in Bush's presidency. So just because he got the support of the people, enough of them to get elected president, that doesn't mean he's going to keep that support.
Mark Hemingway is senior writer for the Weekly Standard, and Molly Hemingway is senior editor at The Federalist. When we return, we'll get Molly's thoughts on the Women's March in Washington.
Have you been too busy to get your associate's, bachelor's, or master's degree? Concordia University, Wisconsin offers 50 online educational options. Find out more at issuesetc.org. Click the Concordia University online logo and enter the program code ISSUES to waive your application fee. Concordia University, Wisconsin is here to strengthen and support the church. Lifelong Lutheran learning. issuesetc.org and click Concordia University, Wisconsin online.
Christians young and old are increasingly pressured to change their beliefs. That's why St. Jude said we need to contend for the faith once for all delivered to the saints. At the San Antonio Worldview Conference, Confessional Lutherans Jonathan Fisk, Jay Weber, Ryan McPherson, and Craig Parton will unmask the false, direct us to Christ and His Word, and defend the faith. The San Antonio Worldview Conference, Saturday, February the 11th, San Antonio, Texas. Visit worldusa.org. worldusa.org.
We love our on-demand listeners. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Memoria Press invites all Issues Etc. listeners to explore our Simply Classical curriculum, a set of full-year academic curriculum packages for children with learning challenges. Our classical writing program and our Christian studies are now based on your favorite CPH Bible storybooks. To learn more, visit classicalspecialneeds.com and use promo code LPR to save on your initial purchase. That's classicalspecialneeds.com.
O Lord, open my lips.
Listen to chapel services live weekday mornings from Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana.
Make haste, O God, to deliver me.
Morning Chapel from Kramer Chapel. Live weekday mornings at 9 Central, 10 Eastern, 8 Mountain, and 7 Pacific at issuesetc.org.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're talking with Mark Hemingway, senior writer for the Weekly Standard, and Molly Hemingway, senior editor at The Federalist, about several issues, including the Women's March in Washington. And, of course, there were mirror marches all over the country as well. Molly, I wanted your thoughts on the Women's March.
Yeah, it was a really massive event. It took place not just in D.C. In fact, the crowd was bigger in Los Angeles than it was Washington, D.C. Major cities across the country hosted most of the population, obviously, who came out to protest Trump. And it was a really big cathartic event for people on the left. And cities, of course, had been Hillary Clinton's stronghold during the 2016 election. She didn't do well with the rest of the country, but people in cities are experiencing a lot of shock and confusion over how it could possibly have happened that Donald Trump won the presidency. And this was their moment to kind of come together in a public ritual of mourning and camaraderie, bringing them together in political action.
Well, Molly, is it, I was commenting to Jeff here earlier today that had Trump beat anyone else, a man, we wouldn't have had a women's march or that kind of a protest. How much of a factor do you think is the fact that he beat Hillary Clinton, the icon of the female icon of the left, in inspiring this kind of protest?
I'm not sure I agree with you. In fact, I was thinking that no matter who had beaten Hillary Clinton, I'm sure there would have been the same type of protest, which is sort of the conundrum that the left finds itself in. They're trying to express this view that Donald Trump is a unique threat to the American public, but they have trouble conveying that message because that's what they've been saying about every single Republican who ever holds office. And so the message doesn't resonate outside of their echo chamber. Although I suppose you might be right that if he had beaten Bernie Sanders or something, no, I still see this type of protest as being a very important thing that the left needs to do. They are inclined toward protest, and they get a lot of value and meaning out of it in a way that conservatives don't. And they had to take 8 years off of protesting. I mean, I've lived in D.C. for a long time. We had nothing but protests during the entire George W. Bush administration. Then you had, you know, the anti-war movement, the anti-globalization movement. Everything just went deep underground for 8 years. And the Women's March, also the last time it was held, these are always just funded by large pro-abortion groups, and the last time they did one was during the George W. Bush administration as well. So this is something you should always expect and get used to and factor into your how to fight or what to fight for calculus whenever a Republican is in office.
Mark, what were your thoughts on the Women's March?
Well, it's hard to say. You know, I remember at the time, and what was it? I think it was 2010. The first Tea Party protest started showing up. I think it was April 15, 2010, and a lot of people dismissed them offhand. But the reality was, is that fall, the Democratic Party, you know, suffered the biggest defeat for a major party in since the end of World War II. So you can't necessarily dismiss these protests out of hand. Further, I would also say that the protests in D.C. really don't mean anything, which is to say that there's so many liberal population centers along the I-95 corridor that getting a big crowd in D.C. doesn't mean much. But the fact that there were crowds in places like St. Louis and Indianapolis and stuff that were also impressive does sort of speak to a lot of angst. But the question is that, you know, whether or not this they'll be able to take this momentum and translate this into something that is meaningful electorally. I wouldn't rule it out, but I just don't think that the dynamics of the liberal movement and further the way that the House and Senate are structured and spread out geographically means that Republicans are in too much danger of losing complete control of Congress. But, you know, even if they flip the Senate, which, you know, is a narrow majority, you know, that could mean a very different Trump presidency. So, you know, having all the enthusiasm on one side of the political fence and the marches being an indicator of that is not something I would completely dismiss out of hand.
Molly, I read a piece going into the weekend by Lori Adelman, an executive director for the website Feministing, and she wrote a piece called How the Women's March, in the New York Times, by the way, How the Women's March Could Resurrect the Democratic Party. She recommended going deeper into identity politics. What do you make of it?
That's interesting. I mean, this is the conundrum, I think, for the left, is that they don't have many options other than going deeper into identity politics, but it is something that really only succeeds if the groups that enjoy identity politics grow quite a bit in the next few years, because until then, majority population are not going to be as enthused by identity politics. We make big divisive issues out of race or sex or whatnot. The fact of the matter is, this was a big year for identity politics. Hillary Clinton was the first female of a major party to run for president, and white women voted for Donald Trump by 9 points. That suggests that women, at least white women, aren't going to be as persuaded by some of these arguments as some other groups might be. So I'm not sure, for the reasons that Mark just pointed out with the geographic problems in play, I'm not sure it's the wisest thing. The thing about this march, it was also interesting, was how exclusive it was. I mean, New Wave Feminists, a genuinely feminist, genuinely pro-life group, were forbidden from being co-sponsors. They were kicked out because they do not support violence in the womb. And there were problems with, you know, already we've had a lot of stuff coming out today where trans activists are upset that people in the march were using objective biological reality to describe women instead of subjective feelings. Identity politics tends to eat itself in ways that are completely insane to other people. And I would think that after years of diminishing marginal returns on this, that the left would see the danger. I mean, they did a lot of women's issues to success in the middle of Obama's presidency, and then that started not working for them as early as 2014. So I'm not sure if that's great advice for them, but on the other hand, who knows? That's really all they have to work with, and sometimes you just use what you have to work with and double down on it.
Mark, what do you make about the flap comparing the sizes of the women's march to the Trump inauguration D.C. turnout?
Well, I mean, it's first of all, it's plainly obvious that the women's march did draw a bigger crowd than the Trump inaugural, and I don't know why it appears that Trump insisted that Sean Spicer, his press secretary, be frog marched out there Saturday night to make the case that somehow the inaugural was bigger, you know, for a lot of the reasons that Molly's touched on.
He didn't say it was bigger than the women's march. He was just saying that it was bigger than the media had reported.
Right, but there were a lot of numbers and then specific details thrown out that were not exactly accurate, not exactly accurate, were the opposite of accurate. And so I don't understand why that in particular is a hill that, you know, the Trump administration would want to die on, and it speaks to Trump's ego somewhat disconcertingly. But, you know, having said that, this is a silly battle to get into for a lot of reasons. You know, like I pointed out, getting a large crowd in Washington really isn't that big a deal. This is just sort of the general opposition that happens when there's a Republican president. And further, I mean, I'm not entirely convinced yet, even though I think it could be a harbinger for a larger political movement, that, you know, this could even have diminishing returns, because protests of this nature tend to be sort of showcases for radicalism. You know, and I'm kind of surprised that's the kind of thing that the Trump administration could have, you know, harped on. I mean, like, you know, a featured speaker at the march was Angela Davis, who's, you know, a radical Marxist, Leninist, Black Panther supporting, Jonestown cult supporting, you know, accessory to murder. And, you know, you could be highlighting the radicalism and say, look, you know, are these the leaders of the movement that you want to support? There's all kinds of criticisms they could have offered, but they didn't offer, you know, legitimate criticisms. They got hung up on petty details about crowd size, and it's really sort of disconcerting that they did that. Now, having said that, if you saw the press conference today, Sean Spicer addressed the issue and handled it much better, framed it in terms of how the press is unfairly adversarial, and that is entirely true. From the very beginning, the press were trying to make a big deal about the relative crowd sizes being some meaningful political indicator, when clearly it doesn't mean anything that we can point to yet. And, you know, what he did there was more sort of classical Washington spinning today, which is, you know, I think perfectly appropriate, rather than demanding that there was some sort of empirical reality that the journalists weren't seeing.
Molly, with only a minute here, given the media attention for the Women's March, what can we expect as far as media coverage for the annual March for Life?
So this is something that pro-lifers are frustrated with year after year after year. The largest annual march in Washington, D.C., and there's no contenders that even come close, is the annual March for Life, and it never gets much media coverage. Sometimes it gets no media coverage. I've always joked that the march should just start marching through the hallways of the Washington Post newsroom, because then they would be forced to cover it better. But in fact, the Washington Post has covered it better in recent years. In general, I think that the media will be so sensitive to the claim that they overcovered the Women's March this weekend that they will do a little bit better coverage of the size and scope of the March for Life. And we'll see. Now, the March for Life takes place on a work day, on a Friday, and unlike the Saturday march of the March for Women's Life, which makes the numbers that the pro-lifers get pretty impressive as well. Usually activities on weekdays don't get the numbers that weekend activities do. But we'll have to wait and see how they cover it. And already we know that they haven't given it the same prominence in anticipation. I mean, for weeks, the New York Times has been covering the Women's March and looking forward to it. That's not what we've seen with the March for Life.
Molly Hemingway is senior editor at The Federalist. Molly, thanks for being our guest.
Thank you.
Mark Hemingway, senior writer for the Weekly Standard. Mark, thank you.
Thanks again.
You can read their columns at our website, issuesetc.org. Click Listen on Demand. Tomorrow on Issues Etc., it's part two of our series on the conscience. Pastor Brian Wolfmiller is going to join us. We're going to talk about four things that inform the conscience. There are things that the conscience needs to know, and it can get accurate information or inaccurate information. We'll talk about that tomorrow with Pastor Wolfmiller. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for listening to Issues Etc.
Listen weekday afternoons to Pastor Todd Wilkin and guests on Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is vital for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our mailing address, Issues Etc., P.O. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. You can also donate at our website, issuesetc.org. Issues Etc. is a production of LPR, Lutheran Public Radio.